This is a CBC original podcast.
You know, at night, it's always hard to tell at night when you land somewhere just what the extent of the damage is. You know, you see the dust still in what lights that are around. You can feel it. You can taste it in your mouth. You know, the car lights as you drive through and turn a corner would sort of illuminate a building that just doesn't make sense in your mind because it seems to be leaning at like a 45-degree angle. And you don't have time to process, you know, what the heck was that? And then you stop somewhere at a sort of a roundabout to try to figure out which way you're going. And right in front of you is just, you know, matchsticks of what was something else. So at night it's always, I mean, I've been to a few earthquakes, and the disorientation of seeing a place at night is real. But let me start at the beginning. I'm Adrienne Arsenault, and this is Backstory, Nepal, 2015.
It is a disaster of untold proportions. An earthquake in Nepal today was so powerful it was felt across South Asia.
The 7.8 magnitude earthquake turned homes and historic buildings into rubble, and areas outside the capital have had little help.
The devastating earthquake in Nepal has killed 1,400 people.
About 2,000 people, at least 2,500 people, more than 4,000 people.
Killing more than 8,000 people.
So knowing you have to go is a no-brainer. I think in the moment when all your energy is geared towards we have to get in, okay, we've got the gear, we know what we're going to do when we land, you just sort of have this expectation that you will land and maybe the flight will be delayed. But what was happening is that, you know, when our flight, and this was happening to a lot of them, but our flight took off from Abu Dhabi towards Kathmandu, and you just get to the point where you're expecting to land. And then if you look at the little map on the screen that's on the back of the seat in front of you, the plane's just going around in a circle. It's going towards Kathmandu and then away from Kathmandu and then towards Kathmandu and then away from Kathmandu. And there are people on the flight who are desperate to get down because on the plane were Nepalese workers who had been living in places like Abu Dhabi and Dubai, sending money back home to Nepal. So these were pretty lonely men. A lot of them had received calls that their family members were gone or hadn't been found or were sleeping outside and were in trouble. And everything they were doing in the Emirates was about those families back in Nepal. And yet in the one moment where they think they were really needed, they weren't there for them. The second time we tried to get in, which is the time we actually got in, sure enough, when we tried to land and we were told we were something like eighth in line to land, and we'd seen that movie the night before and it hadn't succeeded, he got on the loudspeaker and he said something to the effect of, I don't give up. I have my ways. We are getting down. And so people sort of half nervously applauded because it's a bit, you know, it's a slightly weird thing for a pilot to say. And then he came back on a little while later saying, we're now fourth in line to land. Don't give up on me. I'm not giving up on you. You know, more applause. And then at the end, and I think I was rolling on it, he comes back on and he says,
we're going to have a selfie with you after we land in Kathmandu.
You're all going to want to take a selfie with me when we land. And then the plane just sort of, you know, erupted and people applauded. And sure enough, as we were getting off, you know, in this horrible disaster, all these people were taking selfies with the pilot because they were so proud of him for actually landing, actually getting in there. It was so important, and he totally broke the tension. And I think if people could have hugged him, they would have. When we finally landed, it became very obvious that one of the more disturbing and important and intriguing places in Kathmandu at the moment was the place along the river where people were cremated. normally in Kathmandu, cremations happen at this spot. There are three sort of wooden platforms. There are few cremations that happen by day. It's sort of, you know, in the Hindu faith, it's something you just must do, and it's a very special, you know, very important ceremony for people, and it's done with enormous reverence. Well, when we got to the river this time, forget the three platform situation. There were bodies lined up alongside the river's edge, one after another. Too many for the platform, so many that people told us that, that the government had been trying to provide free firewood to people to complete the cremations, but they were running out of firewood, if you can believe it, running out of firewood. There were bodies, we watched them, being taken into the forest just beyond the place of cremation, just to store them until the families could come and people could be properly identified and they could complete the cremations. And I, you know, I've seen cremations before, but I don't think I've ever seen them like this. Lots of fires burning at once, lots and lots of people, and yet so quiet. And, you know, you hear sort of the crackle of the wood, and you hear sometimes people moaning quietly. They were not only, you know, grieving, they were completely exhausted. You know, at some point, it became pretty clear that the places in the biggest need were the places we neither saw nor heard from, because people couldn't get to them. So while it was clear that, that people in Kathmandu still needed help, it was also clear that they were getting some. So like a lot of people, we decided, let's go as far as we possibly can and see what we can see. So we started to drive into the mountains. I mean, it's one of the cruelties of the earthquake that, that part of what makes Nepal so beautiful is part of what made it suffer so much in the earthquake. So we drove, and then we went off a main road, and then we went onto a dirt road, and then we went off a dirt road, and, you know, keeping an eye on the sun and trying to figure out, you know, we're going to have to keep going until it's dark. So just around sunset, we came to what was sort of an impromptu checkpoint, if you will. And it was people just from this village saying, you know, who are you? What have you got for us?
Most of the old people and children are suffering from pneumonia, cold and cough.
Have you seen any aid agencies here?
No.
We haven't seen anybody else. Where are you from? What can you tell us? You know, here's what we need. So we stopped and spoke to them for a while and explained who we were. And, you know, it's hard because you're not an aid group. And so sometimes you feel like a really bad human because you think, what are we doing? You know, you show up in these people's community and they need something. And what are you there to do? You're there to explore what it is they need and relay that information. But I'm sure that doesn't feel very satisfying to them because, you know, you're not bringing food, you're not bringing shelter. So that's, it's hard. But almost invariably, in disaster after disaster, I've been surprised at the extent to which people are happy to see you in a way and patient with you and willing to share. And so this community very kindly said to us,
if you need some safety or something, better to stay here, sir.
Stay with us. See what we are coping with. Tell everybody what we need. And so there was a clearing that they identified for us that we could put our tents in. And so, you know, the kids were amazing. I mean, it is a little bit like turning on a light and it sort of attracts, you know, everything comes towards the lights, the flies, the people, the animals. So all these little munchies came around, and they looked pretty good. Considering what they were going through, they looked pretty good. And it was a very, Tulsi Rubari is a very strong community. So they allowed us to pitch our tent, and we stayed there overnight. And, you know, in the early morning, when you start to hear the birds, there was another sound. And it was little kids. And they had come from the tents and makeshift shelters all around just to sort of stand outside the tents and kind of laugh and giggle at these, you know, crazy people from far away. And so, I mean, how do you not get up and play with the kids? So we all sort of got up at about, you know, 5:45 and started playing with the kids. And then the adults started getting up. And again, I had one of those conversations I'll never forget where, you know, sort of a man wandered down and he was sleepy and he scratched his head and he said, you know, it's so strange that the leopards weren't out last night. I said, what do you mean the leopards? He said, normally the leopards are roaming at night. It's why people don't like sleeping outside. So we started to transmit some stories and realized in the act of doing it that we needed to use the car battery and connect it to an inverter, and that would give us the power to fire up our BGAN satellite phone that we could then use to transmit our stories. And that if you fire up an inverter, you can attach all sorts of things to it, like a power bar. And, you know, the lights sort of went on at some point where we thought, you know, we have enough gas, let's just put the inverter on and go have a conversation amongst ourselves, and we'll just attach a couple power bars and, you know. And then very quickly people started to gather and plug in their devices, their phones, their flashlights, their radios. They were desperate to recharge their radios. And we watched as we were sort of planning what we were doing. We were transmitting our story at the BGAN. We were planning our day. We were watching and realizing that these days in an emergency, connectivity is a huge need for people, a huge acute need. And what was interesting is that people were plugging in their phones, and the moment they got even one bar of a signal, we watched a man call his sister.
Hello?
And it was the first time she'd heard from him since the earthquake. And we watched another man, you know, charge up his radio just enough that he could turn on the radio and start to get information. And people were gathering around and they were listening to the information. And you realize, you know, the world has changed so much that, you know, up there with shelter and food and water, at some point, is going to be connectivity just for the emotional health of people. So that was a serious lesson for us in what people need. So I guess where we are now is that the aftershocks have still rattled people. I mean, physically, but also mentally. They were having a big problem in the early days because thieves would run around and say to people, there's another one coming at noon, or there's another one coming at 6:00. And because there were so many of them and they were so violent and they made you feel nauseous and, as you know, in addition to being scared, people would flee their homes and then the thieves would loot them. So, you know, these people have been doubly victimized, and the aftershocks have taken a serious toll. There are people who say that they still feel like they have sea legs. You know, when you get off a boat and you stand on land and you still feel wobbly, they still feel like that, even when there aren't aftershocks. The aftershocks have also taken down buildings that stayed standing after the first quake. So the assessment of what needs to be rebuilt continues to be redone after every serious aftershock. This is a problem. The reconstruction of schools is a huge problem. The monsoons, though, are vicious. Shelter is such... I mean, it's hard enough to endure a monsoon. How on earth do you endure it if you don't have shelter? So groups like UNDP are working hard to sort of create at least semi-permanent shelter for people. But they need something better than that. So they have a huge amount of work ahead of them.
We are completely, you know, without home, without tent, without food here.
And you've seen nobody coming with shelter, nobody...
No. No one is here. I think you are the first team here.
It's hard covering disasters. I mean, you have lots of inside conversations with yourself about, you know, who am I? What kind of person goes into a disaster and tries to get a sense of what people need and relay that responsibly and accurately and be respectful of the people around you and then leaves? You know, I think this is the thing that a lot of people wrestle with. Your heart is bursting, right? You want to be able to make all the kids laugh, and you'd like to be able to make the structure safe for them. And you want to be able to, you know, give them food and water. And, you know, as a human being, you want to do all those things. And then you say, wait a minute. I have a role here. You know, as best as I can, I'm going to relay the extent of what they need, give people very far away a sense of what it sounds like, smells like, tastes like, feels like to be here. And then hope that the right thing happens. But at some point, you have to leave. And I think it's harder to leave a disaster zone than it is to go to one. I think that's the awkward, uncomfortable, one of the many awkward, uncomfortable things about it is leaving. Backstory is recorded and produced by Cecil Fernandez, with help this week from Sean Brocklehurst, Glenn Kugelstadt, and Sylvia Thompson. I'm Adrian Arsenault.
For more CBC Original Podcasts, go to cbc.ca/originalpodcasts.